This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we examine the problem of systemic abuse of teenagers in the Texas prison system. You've probably heard about the case of Shaquanda Cotton, the 14-year-old sentenced to 7 years for shoving a school monitor. We'll talk with Will Harrell from the Texas ACLU. We'll also hear from Deborah Small as she talks about her work analyzing and advocating for wide-scale prison reform in this country. Deborah was speaking at this year's Left Forum in New York. And we'll listen to author Joel Covell speaking at the Brecht Forum about his new book, Overcoming Zionism, Creating a Single Democratic State in Israel-Palestine. Stay with us.
Welcome to Law and Disorder. This is Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm Michael Smith, New York City attorney and author.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
I'm Dahlia Hashad, director of the USA program at Amnesty International.
Here on Law and Disorder, we four lawyers and activists will strive to be your eyes and ears, your early warning system, your educators, counselors, and advocates. Here, we'll talk about the laws, practices, and procedures that we believe are strangling democracy. We'll be in the courts, in the books, on the streets, and here on the radio with you. We hope that we'll be lawyers you will like.
The great civil liberties attorney Bill Kunstler saw it coming. The police state is emerging, he warned. It's coming piece by piece, before and especially after September 11th.
Last year in Paris, Texas, a 14-year-old black freshman allegedly shoved a hall monitor at Paris High School in a dispute over entering the building before the school day had officially begun. Shaquanda Cotton was sentenced to 7 years in prison. She had no prior arrest record, and the hall monitor was not seriously injured. Just 3 months earlier, another Texas teenager of the same age was sentenced to probation for burning down her family's house. She was white. Joining us to discuss this case and the issue of juvenile justice in Texas is Will Harrell. Will is the former director of the National Police Accountability Project. He is currently executive director of the Texas ACLU and co-chair of the Texas Coalition Advocating Justice for Juveniles. He is a primary advocate advancing a bill to reform the Texas Youth Commission. Will was also appointed to a panel that reviews cases of arbitrary detention extensions for youth in Texas. Welcome to Law and Disorder, Will.
Thanks for having me.
Will, you successfully advocated for Shaquanda Cotton's release. Can you tell us in a nutshell about her case and your subsequent involvement?
Well, Shaquanda had gotten in trouble in school. This is a school-to-pipeline scenario where she had allegedly shoved a teacher. Now, witnesses believe that the teacher shoved her, but it didn't matter to the judge.
And that was because she was entering the building before the school day had officially begun?
Correct. And my understanding is she was getting there early because she was to be provided with certain medication, and that's why she was there early.
And she's 14, or was 14 at the time.
Didn't have a history of trouble. You know, had, you know, a scuffle here and there in school, but kids will be kids, you know. And so, but a young African-American woman in that part of the state with an attitude doesn't do so well in front of a white judge.
Where is this in Texas? Paris, Texas?
Paris, Texas is sort of northeast Texas. It's an area of the state of Texas that the civil rights March never quite made it to.
Hmm.
It's really like, you know, you go there and you think you're in the Deep South circa 1950. I mean, not much has changed in terms of segregation and racist attitudes. And it's really an unpleasant part of this state. There are many of those, don't get me wrong, but East Texas, and particularly in remote rural East Texas, there are serious issues of race that really has not been fully addressed. I look at the Sequoia Cotton case as one of those instances that now a crisis in one little girl's life has caused the town to really take a look at these issues. Blatant disparities in that town in terms of, you know, policing and racial profiling, the way that, of course, the government, and in this case a judge, treats people of color.
Will, she was sentenced to 7 years in prison.
Well, what this is it's an indeterminate sentence, and it she could have been there for 7 years, but it doesn't mean she has to be there for 7 years, and that's one of the institutional problems, is that kids go into TYC right now and on an indeterminate sentence, and suddenly the local administrators of TYC become the judge and the jury. They can decide when and for what reason a person gets out or not. And what we discovered as a member of this review panel is that over 90% of kids in TYC have stayed beyond the mandatory minimum length of stay. And many of those instances are completely arbitrary. In Shaquanda's case, she stayed an extra year because she was busted with contraband. Well, you
socks.
Look a little bit closer, it's an extra pair of socks. I mean, that's how bad it gets. And her case exemplified a failed system. And one of the things that right now a major omnibus reform bill is making its way through the legislature, that's Senate Bill 103, what it will require is that there will be a central department within TYC that only has the authority to extend the length of stay, but the local facilities will have to make an objective finding that there's a good reason for that extended length of stay, and we think that that will eliminate, you know, the vast majority of those extensions.
I read also that one reason there have been retaliatory actions and extensions of sentences is if the youth inmates file complaints, say, for issues of sexual abuse.
Well, that's right. Think about, you know, what you're setting up. You know, one of the biggest scandals being discussed today, although I don't think it's isolated, is the West Texas State School scandal. Their teachers were telling kids straight up, you participate in my, you know, receive my sexual advances and don't say anything or I'll keep you here till you're 21. Think about how difficult it would be for a kid to report the abuser when the very abuser is the person who decides when they get out.
Will, have there been cover-ups in this?
There's no question. There's no question there's been cover-ups. But a lot of people, ever since the conservator was appointed, the ACLU and other groups have been given access to the information. Texas Rangers have been investigated. I mean, the whole state, if not country, is watching. As a result, there's been a mass exodus of TYC employees. Now, of course, many of them aren't bad people, and I think they're leaving because morale is at an all-time low. But those with something to hide have certainly, you know, hit the road.
Will, in addition to the board resignations, was the leadership of the Youth Commission held accountable in any fashion under law?
Not yet. Their people have left, but they may not escape the long arm of the law, and we'll see. They've created an entity, an inspector general that has been investigating the entire system and has identified over 1,000 cases of abuse, many of them sexual abuse. So far, there's only been a couple of indictments, but I think you'll see many to come. I think they're just developing their cases. I mean, you know, this is an unusual situation because the whole world is watching and people are demanding the results. And so I think that the system may very well do the right thing in this case under these circumstances.
Where is Shaquanda Cotton right now, Will?
She's back home in Paris, Texas.
How's she doing?
She seems to be doing okay. She's certainly glad to be out. You know, has been really inspired by her experience. She wants to be a lawyer one day, and I hope she'll be a lawyer and a member of the National Lawyers Guild while she's at it.
I hope so, too.
She's been really activated by her experience, and you know, she has the capacity, I think, to really be a leader of reform, and we hope to involve her as the legislative reforms take effect, and there will be an ongoing effort to implement the reforms, and I hope she'll be part of that.
One thing we didn't mention in discussing her case is that a few months before Shaquanda was arrested, another Texas teenager, same age, was sentenced actually to probation. Her crime, burning down her family's house. Welcome, she was white.
Welcome to Northeast Texas. I mean, you know, I know that that might be shocking to your listeners, but I live here. I mean, that's just kind of the way it is, and we do what we can to reform this system, but racism in that part of the state runs deep, and it's going to take a long time to get to a more equitable society in these rural areas, particularly in East Texas.
Will, just tell us briefly, I know that Texas state legislators are rushing to pass bills as part of this attempt to overhaul the system. Is that progressing?
Absolutely. The Senate unanimously endorsed Senate Bill 103. The House version was unanimously voted out of the House Corrections Committee earlier this week. There's some procedural things that have to happen, but I have no doubt that this bill will pass. And I can just tell you that in all my years of legislative advocacy, I've never seen a more profound, progressive reform piece of legislation. But that said, you know, if the necessary appropriations don't follow the bill, if, you know, the wrong people are put into place, because there's going to be a lot of new people coming into the system, if they don't have the commitment to see these reforms through, then, you know, it will be for naught. But I think that we have set up enough institutional markers in this bill that the advocacy groups and kids like Shaquanda will have a seat at the table and to continue to monitor vigilantly these reforms.
We're talking to Will Harrell from the ACLU of Texas, National Lawyers Guild member as well. I read that almost 90% of juveniles incarcerated inside Texas youth prisons, as you mentioned, were there on indeterminate sentences, but many would have been eligible for release after serving only 9 months.
That's right.
Again, at the discretion of prison authorities.
6 months or 9 months, actually. It depends on what you go in for. That determines the minimum length of stay, but there's two variables that affect when you actually get out. I think the average length of stay is about a year or a year and a half. So nobody gets out in 6 months or 9 months. And one of the biggest problems is this whole what they call a resocialization program that, quite frankly, through the legislation and our advocacy, is about to be completely scrapped. It's some junk science, or almost like a 12-step program where, like, the first step is a kid has to admit his or her guilt. And if they don't do that, they can't transfer to the next step. They have to go through four steps with three sub-steps in them. Until you get to the fourth step, you're not eligible for release. So kids that don't go with the program, you know, are never going to get out. And many of them stay for 3 to 4 years. And kids with independent minds like Shaquanda won't make it out. You know, one of the first steps is to acknowledge your guilt.
And something that's supposed to be separate as part of the adjudicative process, not when someone is serving time.
It's required even if kids who never, you know, who pled not guilty, were convicted anyway, who have an appeal going, they're supposed to admit their guilt in the process, which could affect their criminal
And Shaquanda case. Did not do that, as
she
you said.
She would not do that. Therefore, she probably would have stayed until she was 21 under the old system.
Just an incredible, incredible situation. Will, what is the composition in terms of race of the juvenile inmates?
Well, no surprises here. It's grossly disparate. While, you know, kids of color make up about 30% of the population of the state, they're well over 70% of the population of the Texas Youth Commission.
Will, is there anything else you'd like to add?
Well, you know, one thing, interestingly, because I'm certain that most of your listeners, or a good part of them, are probably attorneys, is to keep in mind that this, not a single lawsuit was necessary in this instance, and that often as lawyers we think that we need to rush off to a federal court for reform. Well, we don't think so much like that down here in the Fifth Circuit, but we often find allies in the legislature, and the legislature actually did the right thing and in terms of the reform of the Texas Youth Commission.
Ending on a positive note to what has to be one of the most outrageous violations of civil and constitutional rights, the case of Shaquanda Cotton and the many, many other many other youths who have been in custody in the state of Texas. Will Harrell, it's been a delight to have you with us.
Always great to talk to you, Bog.
And we look forward to updates in the future.
See you at the Gill Convention in Washington, D.C.
That's right. Bye-bye, Will.
Bye-bye.
We go now to hear an excerpt from a speech by Deborah Small at the Left Forum. The panel was entitled Prisons, Prisoners, and Political Prisoners, and it was chaired by our own Michael Smith. Deborah Small is the founder of BreakTheChains.org, an organization that seeks to build a national movement within communities of color against punitive drug policies. Let's have a listen.
Deborah Small, one of the most knowledgeable people about this so-called war on drugs and its effects on communities that we have in the country. She was with the Drug Policy Alliance and now is head of her own organization called Breaking the Chains. It's here in New York City, and we're very happy to have her here at the panel. Deborah, thanks.
Thank you. Good afternoon. I'm really happy to be here. I live here in New York, and I actually spend a lot of time in this area because I like sushi, and one of the best places is across the street in the Japanese market. So it's, and I've never actually been in Cooper Union in all the years that I've been in New York. I've not actually been in this building, so it's actually great for me to be here, and particularly for this event. And I must admit that when Michael invited me and I looked at the program, I was like, wow, you know, are there really that many left people left in the U.S. that could actually fill up a program like this? And I say that partly in jest and half seriously, because I think that we're at a very critical point in our country right now, and where we have a greater need than ever for a really active, conscious left, and a left that looks at the holistic way in which the problems that we're dealing with today are connected. And so I want to talk about one small part of it, and how it connects both to what Sophia was talking about and also to many of the issues that you all are concerned about. But before I do, I want to just mention an article that I read this morning. I've given up buying the New York Times ever since Bush got elected. I refuse to spend money for that newspaper. But there was a very interesting column by David Brook called The End of Neoliberalism, which I thought was really good, particularly coming from him, because it was making the point that since 1980, we've had this kind of false liberalism in this country that's liberal but not too liberal, that's challenging but that's not too challenging, that questions the status quo but only a certain aspect of it. And that he felt that that particular trend was coming to an end because the new generation of younger people today are actually more abashedly liberal. They're not apologetic for it. They're more confrontational. They see more of the connection between the way in which our economic system is organized and the condition of their lives and the way in which we use our power, both here and abroad. And that was one of the most encouraging things that I had seen in a long, long time. So it actually invigorated me. So you're going to hear some of that in my comments this morning. Sophia was talking about political prisoners and the way in which our government uses the law to suppress political activity. And so I just want to start out by making the connection that I'm sure everybody in this room is aware of what happened here in New York in 1971 in Attica, which was one of the biggest prison rebellions in the country, and which resulted in an unconscionable number of deaths of innocent people when the New York State troopers came in, guns blazing. Well, I'm not sure how many New Yorkers make the connection between what happened in Attica in 71 and the enactment of the Rockefeller drug laws in 73. Those two things are directly related in the same way that the case that she talked about is related to what happened with COINTELPRO in the 60s, and the fact that the modern day war on drugs, which got really ratcheted up in the late 70s and early 80s, was a direct response to the gains that had been made, both politically as a result of the civil rights movement, but even more importantly, in the consciousness of people in the community who were no longer willing to just continue to wait and hope for progress, but who were demanding progress, and not just in things that didn't cost money, like where you sat on the bus or where you got to buy your food, but real progress in terms of addressing the inequitable way in which power is distributed in this country and wealth is distributed in this country. And so and the history of this country has always been that we criminalize that behavior which we can't deal with or don't want to deal with or don't feel that we can manage. And we do it in a way to obfuscate the ways in which that behavior is indicative of other problems in our society that we don't really want to address. And so I want to start by saying that the majority of the people in our country who have been labeled criminals and who are in some way caught up in the criminal justice system have not done anything that is inherently criminal, other than the fact that we have said by our laws that these acts are criminal. And I want to just stop people because, you know, there is nothing essentially wrong with the drugs that we have labeled as illicit that justifies the use of law enforcement to control it, the locking up of people who do it, and the long amount of sentences that we give people for it. And yet that has been the principal focus of law enforcement in this country now for the past 30 years. And not coincidentally, it's a focus that's almost exclusively on people of color. And to me, I always think about the fact that if we had a law in this country that said that we were going to prosecute people for fornication and we were going to give them mandatory sentences, and the more often you got caught, the longer you were going to go to prison, and we decided we were going to vigorously enforce these laws, and we did exactly what we do with the drug law. We look for informants, people who are going to snitch on other people that they knew or who engaged in illegal sex. And we send in undercover agents, literally, to find out who the violators are. And we say to family members, if you don't let us know who's sneaking into your family member's bedroom at night, we're going to come after you because you're a conspirator helping them to commit these violations. And if we did that, and the only people who ended up behind bars were primarily black and brown, everybody would know there was something wrong with that, because even white people don't believe that they don't commit those kinds of crimes. All right? Even white folks don't believe that they don't engage in illicit sex, which is one reason why they're so fine with their politicians doing it. So I just have to ask, what is it that allows us to continue for the last 25, 30 years to lock up people for behavior that is done and engaged in by every segment of this population openly and knowingly? Because see, where I sit, drugs are legal for white Americans. Drugs are legal for affluent Americans. Because you can buy marijuana, you can smoke cocaine, you can shoot up heroin, you can do what you want to do and not really worry about the police coming looking for you. And if by some unfortunate circumstance you do actually get arrested, you can count on the fact that the local prosecutor is going to bend over backwards to find a way to divert yourself out of the system or make sure that you get the most lenient sentence possible. And yet for people of color, it's exactly the opposite. Now, I've been home this last weekend because the U.S. Sentencing Commission is getting ready to have another public hearing on the issue of cocaine sentencing policy. And one of the major issues they're going to deal with is the crack cocaine sentencing disparity. And I've been trying to challenge myself to think of, like, I'm supposed to write testimony for this. And I'm like, okay, what is there to say that hasn't been said already? Nothing. We all know that there's no justification in terms of the actual difference in the drugs to have a difference between how you treat powder cocaine versus how you treat crack cocaine. There's no pharmacological justification for it at all. There's no justification with respect to addictiveness, because all the science that we've had tells us that what makes a drug addictive is the mode of administration. So the fact that you're smoking something is going to make it more addictive to you than the fact that you are sniffing it. And if you decided to shoot it up in your veins, that would make it even more addictive in terms of how likely you were to develop a problem with it. And it wouldn't matter whether you were talking about nicotine, cocaine, heroin, methamphetamine, it's all the same. They say, well, the reason we have this problem, that we have a higher penalty, is because it's more attached to violence. Well, One of the interesting things that studies have shown is that a lot of the violence generated by the crack market is the direct result of having imposed mandatory minimums, because the drug market is like any other market. And when you take all of the mature, rational people out of the market and lock them up for 5, 10, 15 years, then what you end up is a situation where people then have to substitute, so they go and they recruit young people. Now, it doesn't matter whether you're talking about black youth, white youth, native youth, Asian youth. Youth are somewhat irresponsible and limited in their control mechanisms. And so you add really young people engaged in an illegal activity and a proliferation of guns, and what you have is an epidemic of homicide. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure that out. It's the same thing that would happen in any situation where you do the same thing. And yet what we've done this, and now we say, oh my God, look at these horrible young black men. We have to find some way to control them. We have to find some way to monitor them. And what's pernicious is that here in New York, which, you know, in 85, 86 was outrageously caught up in the crack cocaine hysteria. You know, you had 48 hours on crack street. You had all kinds of reports talking about how the communities were going to pot as a result of this new drug. Well, fast forward 10 years, 15 years, and what do we find? Black youth, particularly in New York, but in almost every major city in this country, have overwhelmingly rejected cocaine as a drug of choice. Their drug of choice is marijuana, second by some forms of alcohol. I forget what they call that stuff, malt liquor or whatever that nonsense is. But they're not doing coke. They're not doing heroin. They're not doing meth. They're not even doing ecstasy. What they do is that they smoke marijuana, usually in the side of a cigar shell known as a blunt. So what do we have now? Now, what most people would think that was a good thing. You would think that was a good thing, that if you went from having a generation of people in the 80s who were out there selling crack and hanging out on the corners and shooting each other up, and in the 90s they were like, hell no, crack is whack, so nobody is doing that. You would think that was a good thing. But what has been our public policy response? New York City now leads the country in arresting young people for marijuana, more than any other city in this country. We went from an average of 6,000 to 7,000 arrests up until 1994-95 to a peak of 60,000 in the year 2000. And we've now flattened out between 40,000 and 50,000 arrests a year. Does it surprise you to know that 75 to 80% of those arrests are of young people of color in those same poor neighborhoods that have the majority of the dropouts, the majority of the criminal defendants, the majority of the people who are unemployed and not fitting into our society, and yet somehow they don't get around to arresting too many people in this neighborhood around NYU or Columbia, where I guarantee you per capita there's as much marijuana smoking in it, but much better quality too. So you have to ask, what's up with that? How many people in this state, in this city, paid attention to the report last month about the fact that the NYPD stopped and frisked 508,000 people in 2006? That's a 500,000 New Yorkers, 55% of whom were African American. And if you did the age demographics, I bet you the percentage of those who were between the ages of 16 and 25 was even higher. And yet you don't see any public outcry about that. The Community Service Society issued a report last year talking about the fact that half of all black males who don't finish high school are unemployed. And almost half of the ones who do are unemployed too. What is that saying about our state? We spend more money now locking young men up than we do in sending them to college. And we say it's because of them. Because they're criminal, because they're delinquent, because they don't care, because they're all trying to be gangsters. And yet, you know, people on Wall Street are making millions of dollars on promoting things like Get Rich or Die Trying. And yet it's the youth's problem that they're out there doing that. What is that saying? We basically send a message to youth of color that we would rather incarcerate you than educate you. That the path that we have for you is a quick one from schools to prison. And we're doing it for a variety of reasons. One, because it makes our economy look good.
That was Deborah Small speaking at the Left Forum in New York. We now return to the rest of the speech by Deborah Small at the Left Forum. The panel was titled Prisons, Prisoners, and Political Prisoners. Let's have a listen.
And if you did the age demographics, I bet you the percentage of those who were between the ages of 16 and 25 was even higher. And yet you don't see any public outcry about that. The Community Service Society issued a report last year talking about the fact that half of all black males who don't finish high school are unemployed. And almost half of the ones who do are unemployed too. What is that saying about our state? We spend more money now locking young men up than we do in sending them to college. And we say it's because of them. Because they're criminal, because they're delinquent, because they don't care, because they're all trying to be gangsters. And yet, you know, people on Wall Street are making millions of dollars on promoting things like Get Rich or Die Trying. And yet it's the youth's problem that they're out there doing that. What is that saying? We basically send a message to youth of color that we would rather incarcerate you than educate you. That the path that we have for you is a quick one from schools to prison. And we're doing it for a variety of reasons. One, because it makes our economy look good, because we don't have jobs for these people. And if they actually were included in the unemployment rolls, the economy would not look so good. So if you lock them up and keep them under criminal justice supervision so that they're not looking for a job, then you don't have to count them. It's like they're invisible. And your economy looks real good. If you lock people up, you can make them do work in prison that they couldn't find on the outside. So you got people behind bars making furniture, making jeans, doing all kinds of jobs that no one would hire them for on the outside. Why? Because they get to pay them 25 cents a day. 25 cents a day. Those are slave wages under any definition of the term. How many firms on Wall Street are making huge profits on the prison industrial complex? Huge profits on the backs of poor people. Huge profits on people who've been locked out of the system and told that it's their fault, that there's not a place for them. And heaven forbid that you actually manage to get out after having served a 5, 10 year, 15 sentence, and they haven't found a reason to revoke your butt right away within the first year. What's waiting for you? No housing, because if you have a drug conviction, you can't get public housing, can't qualify for educational loans, you can't get most civil service jobs, and you lose your right to vote. So we now have 1 in 12 African American men in this country who are disenfranchised. And even with the restoration of voting rights that have occurred in some states in the last 5 years, that number has been outstripped by the additional number who've been disenfranchised as a result of convictions since then. Do you think that even the Bush people, as clever as they are, would have been able to steal two elections if you had an additional almost 2 million voters that were voting and casting their votes in the other direction? See, everybody suffers from this system. Everybody suffers. We act as if somehow this doesn't touch us, in the same way that Americans act like the war in Iraq doesn't touch them, because they're not fighting it. We get to comment on it, we get to have a vote about it, but since we don't have a draft and it's not our kids who are actually going over to fight, it can be something for commentary. I'm a product of the 70s. I remember when my generation left school, left work, said we can't continue to act with business as usual because people's lives are at stake here and abroad. I have not seen a commensurate level of commitment in this country around that. And I can tell you that unless we wake up and see that the things that are moving all of these things, all of these issues, is the same basic thing, which is unfettered capitalism and corporate greed. There is no problem in this country, whether you're talking about criminal justice, human rights, economics, healthcare, the environment, that in some way is not linked to our willingness to act as if greed is good, and that what's good for GM is good for America. And the overall mission, not just of Bush, but of the people who financed him, and quite frankly, they're the same people who financed the Democrats, is to make Americans believe that we don't have the right to expect anything from our government other than for them to defend us occasionally from terrorists, hopefully, and take our taxes. So we don't have a right to expect health care. We don't have a right to expect education. We don't have a right to expect that in our old age that we're going to be taking care of dignity no matter how long we worked in this country. We don't have a right to expect that if you make a mistake when you're 16, that it's not going to get carried on in your life until you're 86. We've been brainwashed to believe that we don't have a right to any of those things, and that any money we give our government, they're going to waste, that they're going to blow, that they're not going to take care of. And yet it's corporate America that's wasting our money. It's corporate America that's bought our government. It's corporate America that's running everything from private prisons to a private war. And the consequences of continuing this is not only continued militarization, because we now have a war for everything. We got a war on crime, a war on drugs, a war on poverty, a war on terrorism, all of which are problems that cannot be addressed militarily. But we've been brainwashed in believing that if we fight enough wars against these things, one day we'll win. Well, winning may look a lot different than most of us think it is. I think winning has already occurred. And if you want to know what it looks like, go back and read 1984. Thank you.
I don't know if there's much that we can add to that.
We go now to hear an excerpt from a speech given by author Joel Covell. He spoke at the Brecht Forum recently about the release of his new book, Overcoming Zionism, Creating a Single Democratic State in Israel-Palestine, published by Pluto Press. Let's have a listen.
I'm here principally because I recently composed a book, Overcoming Zionism, and the book is not primarily about the ecology of Israel-Palestine, but about the Zionist entity as such, and its principal goal is to break a taboo, namely, thou shalt not speak critically of the state of Israel in this society. And my means of doing so is to just ignore it entirely, speak as truthfully as I can about the state of Israel, letting the chips fall where they may. And in fact, if you speak truthfully about the state of Israel, you're talking about a culture of death. And Hillary's lovely presentation poignantly reveals that culture of death as it works itself out in one aspect of this entity known as the Jewish state. That my book takes up the history, the logic of Zionism, and issues such as the Holocaust and the character of the Jewish state and its bad conscience and its ineluctable racism, and concludes that inasmuch as no state has the right to exist, only insofar as it preserves human rights, and insofar as the state of Israel is a systematic, is a machine, really, for the destruction of human rights. And as I said, a culture of death. It doesn't have the right to exist, and it should be replaced with a single democratic entity or polity, which we call a state, but as we were talking about over dinner, we don't even like that either, because states are kind of rotten in and of themselves. But we make a little compromise to the existing level of discourse, call it a single state solution. And I think we're going to win this one. I think it's going to be a long time, but I think the facade of Zionism is collapsing under its tremendous evils that it represents and manifests, and its lack of any human dignity or integrity, and as you see witnessed Hillary's presentation. Now, in the middle of the book is a rather brief section called Making the Desert Desolate, which is a commentary on one of the prime slogans, the propaganda slogans of the Zionist enterprise, namely that we made the desert bloom. To this end, that considerable amount of legitimation of Zionism, which has served it so well over the years, has sought to indicate that whereas once the country was barren, it was a home of primitives, of people of no civilization, no culture, no humanity, etc., etc., now it was being taken over by the higher powers that represented the Enlightenment, West, the scientific movement of society, and these were going to be applied to this hitherto barren entity known as Palestine. It was going to turn into the blooming desert of Israel. I mean, there are a lot of people at work there about that. Israel actually has the highest percentage of people with advanced technical and scientific degrees of any country in the world. And a lot of them are pretty expert in these kinds of things, although most of them make weapons, as you know. The truth, however, could not be more radically divergent from the propaganda, and that from the ecological perspective, you already heard quite enough, and I'll tell you a little bit more. Most of what I'll talk about is to relate this to the process of Zionism itself, so we can have a sort of a perspective on it. I mean, after all, the way a society takes care of nature is consonant with the way it takes care of life in general, including human life. Humanity lives as part of nature by transforming nature. Our very being is the transformation. Everything you see around you is nature transformed in one way or another by labor. So it is that the ecological state of a society is a manifestation of its social condition. And if the society is a culture of death, then its ecology will also be a culture of dying nature. And this, in fact, is the case despite all the good intentions and some undeniable technical advances. Israel introduced drip agriculture, or not introduced it, but developed it that is to say, a form of agriculture that was able to make do with rather little water. There was a while there where the actual agricultural productivity of the land was very good. That while is quite a while ago. Not just the West Bank, but the entirety of Israel is now increasingly barren, increasingly unable to support agricultural production. Much of that has been turned over to tourism, as a matter of fact. But that's another story. Certain statistics will tell us, and I'll be reading in part from this book so you can get a feeling for how it works. Just some facts here. All of Israel's rivers are seriously polluted except for the upper Jordan, and some have been polluted to literally lethal levels. There was an episode in, when was it, 1989, I guess it was, when there was a Jewish Olympics being held there, and members of the Australian team fell into this river from a bridge, and about four of them died, actually, immediately on the spot from the submersion in the River Litani and near Tel Aviv. And some of the others suffered unbelievable amounts. All that's been documented. It's probably the most toxic river on earth. Yeah, you know about that. Yeah. There's a good book about this, although it's basically a Zionist book by a man named Alon Tal, Pollution in a Promised Land, it's called. University of California Press, 2002. It's quite detailed. But very little about the territories. It's mostly about the Israel itself. Some other facts just worth noting. The lower Jordan River is called, quote, a little more than a drainage ditch for polluted runoff. 88% of Tel Aviv's wells contain persistent organic pollutants. As for the air, a quadrupling of nitrous oxide emissions have been observed since 1980. Asthma rates among children have gone from 5.6% in 1980 to 11% in 1989, 17% in 2002. Israel has one of the highest breast cancer incidences in the world, and the 32% increase in the 1990s. In the 1970s, the breast milk of Israeli women contained some 800 times the concentration of benzene hexachloride as American women, who have their own problems in this respect. We're talking about really massive pollution in a country that was supposed to make the desert bloom. I say that this list can be extended indefinitely, but what we really want to know is the relationship between the ecological crisis of Israel and the Zionism that animates the Jewish state. In other words, separating out the Israeli contribution to environmental degradation from those of other nations and bracketing for the moment the forces of capital accumulation that degrade ecologies in all nations. Whenever there's capitalism and accumulation, there's going to be ecological degradation. That's the thesis of my book, The Enemy of Nature. But there's every nation has its own specific form or profile, or you might say, of the way it handles nature. Some with care, some with concern, some with more or less brutal degradation, which you just can't reduce it to whether they're capitalist or not. You have to see how these people actually approach nature. And since Zionism is the dominant force, it's the animating force behind the entire project in the State of Israel, we have to try to understand how Zionism itself deals with nature and how much this desolation of nature is a Zionist product. Zionism's obsession has been to preserve the Jewishness of its state at all costs. Well, one of those costs needs now to be taken into account, namely the incessant pressure to fill Israel with Jews in order to keep a step ahead of the Palestinians and to preserve and reinforce the myth that Israel is the supreme haven for all Jews everywhere in their perpetual struggle against anti-Semitic exterminism. This so-called demographic imperative has made Israel the only state, and certainly the only state among Western industrial lines, hell-bent to augment its population. Hell-bent indeed. What country would not experience environmental woes with a six-fold population increase in half a century in a context of rapid industrialization? There's a rough rubric in environmental circles according to which the overall burden on ecosystems in a given nation may be formulaically expressed as population plus affluence plus technology. That is, the more people and the more money they have for purposes of consumption, and the more does their economy rely upon earth-disrupting industrial technologies, then the worse the environmental impact. It is generally appreciated that a kind of reciprocal relationship exists between the first term and the second plus the third, according to the principle that a nation becomes wealthier, so does it tend to limit its population. Thus the grouping of the teeming poor nations or south on one side and the less populous, rich, industrial ones, northern countries on the other, as different contributors. The north is, of course, the greater contributor, even though it has fewer people. But all would agree that a country that aggravates all three factors is an environmental bandit. Thus the world worries about China, the colossus of ecological degeneration, owing to its huge population and runaway economy, and now also India, playing catch-up along the same lines. Israel is much too small to pose a problem in itself to the global ecology, though it is certainly a big problem to its neighbors. In fact, its diminutive size, roughly equal to that of New Jersey, adds a factor of concentration that aggravates the internal dilemma. But the Jewish state is most certainly an environmental bandit, even more than the Asian giants, for China and India, by and large, consider their immense populations to be a problem and have made various efforts to bring it into line. Israel considers the population to be a problem, but only insofar as there's not enough of it. They have to keep trying to bring more and more people, as now they're bringing Russians in, even many of whom are not even Jews, but they will toe the Zionist line. Now, to skip a little bit, the most serious of the environmental dilemmas, and this you really have to keep this in mind, whenever you're thinking about the region, and particularly the wars of Israel, is the question of water. After all, the air may stink, but there is plenty of air available and breezes to sweep away the pollutants. Not so the water, given the naturally arid condition of the land and the fact that pollutants largely tend to migrate to the underground aquifers that supply a major portion of its water. Great attention has been given to Israel's arrogation of regional water supplies, a process which reached a zenith in the 67 war, whose prime motivation, in fact, is widely recognized to have been a control over water resources. Blustering and propaganda, but the big point was to get control of the Jordan River and the aquifers thereon, which they succeeded to do. It is less often appreciated that this has proven insufficient to slake Zion's thirst, unsurprisingly, in view of the stimulus to Israel's sense of entitlement provided by effective control over the Jordan River. Presently, the Jewish state faces both an absolute shortage of water owing to persistent overconsumption as well as persistent contamination of the existing water thanks to rampant, quote-unquote, development and industrialization. Characteristically, the problem is being dealt with by denial, as by lowering the hypothetical red line below which water shortages are deemed dangerous because of incursion of water from the sea, and also because of threat to the great pumping system necessary to lift the water to the cities, which stands to be wrecked once the pumps are exposed. Grandiose plans are on the books to annually return to the aquifers 2 billion meters of pure water necessary to stave off collapse of the system, but this is quite a pie in the sky regimen, which will cost incredible amounts of money and can never be carried out under the level of crisis that Israel has to undergo. But, of course, there is always Israel's godfather to be approached for another handout. And one thing could be added that, you know, basically the monies for the wall, the apartheid wall, a lot of them came from guess which country between the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans in the Western Hemisphere, not Canada.
That was author Joel Covell speaking at the Brecht Forum about his new book, Overcoming Zionism, Creating a Single Democratic State in Israel-Palestine.
Visit us on the web at lawanddisorder.org. You can tell us what you think or listen to a past show.